amount of time? Like, is that hard stop?
30 minutes.
Okay, 11:30.
Fine.
Unless there's so much.
I did not set the time limit. You can always get into a Muslim's garage because you know the code is 7865. All right, salawat. All right, so it is Sunday night, so we are going to be keeping a strict time limit, so this will end at 11:30, okay? So I will go through these questions rather quickly, and I know... Sheikh is always efficient with his time, so I don't have to say anything about that. So, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh, is it right for parents to delay a nikah between a boy and a girl if they clearly have feelings for one another based on that they don't have their degrees? So they don't have their educational degrees, I'm assuming.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So there are a couple of things that we need to consider here. I do not think it is wise for parents to delay the marriage of their children because of school and education. And the reason is non-Muslims are able to get bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, and PhDs with boyfriends and girlfriends, and that doesn't seem to derail their education. So why would it be a problem if someone actually gets married a halal way? So if anything, it can help them cope with the stress and the difficulties of getting a degree. Now with that said, I do not believe that it is wise to go against the wishes of your parents and marry whoever you want and ignore their feelings and their wishes. I've seen it happen time and time again. I just don't believe that there will be barakah in your marriage if you insist on marrying someone that your parents are completely opposed to. You should try your best to convince them, to try to get their blessings, but you don't want to create a rift between you and your parents by just marrying someone who you know that they don't approve of. If they don't approve of someone because of a silly reason, because you know they're not from the same country or from the same village or whatever it is, then I think that you have to be wise and maybe reach out to someone who your parents respect, who can have influence over them, rather than to blow up and to rant and go off and do whatever you want. So there needs to be a balance. So on the one hand, parents have a duty to help their children get married and not make the permissible difficult, because as we said last night, that when you close the doors on halal, you're basically opening the doors of haram. So that is something that all parents need to keep in mind. And I think it's a total misconception and it's completely unfounded to think that your son or your daughter is not going to finish their education if they recite a nikah. You know, if anything, that will motivate them to take their studies more seriously so they can finish their degrees and establish a family. So I actually think that it can be a great motivator. Oftentimes what happens is that parents, they tell their you know, their sons or their daughters, oh, you're too young to get married. Well, that's the reason why so many kids are immature, because you constantly remind them that you're not ready for marriage. And guess what? They behave as people who are not ready for marriage. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you treat them like children, they're going to act like children. But if you train them to think like adults, then hopefully that will be reflected in their behavior.
Excellent. For females, is it okay to wear baggy clothes rather than abaya? For example, baggy pants and an oversized shirt which completely covers the shape of one's body.
Yeah, so when it comes to hijab, you have really three elements that constitute proper hijab. The first and the most important aspect of the hijab is that you are not adorning yourself, right? So adorning yourself in front of a non-mahram is not allowed. And that applies to, you know, makeup. Anything that would be seen as zina is not allowed in front of non-mahram. You need to have the khimar, which is the head covering. Your hair has to be covered. And, you know, the only things that are allowed to be shown to a non-mahram are your hands, you know, from the wrist to the fingers, and your face. Beyond that, everything has to be covered, including your feet. And this is an aspect of the hijab that's often neglected, or sisters don't pay enough attention to it, especially in the summertime. So your feet are part of your hijab. Now, when it comes to the jilbab, and these are Quranic terms, by the way, the jilbab is a garment that conceals, it's a loose garment that conceals the shape of a woman's body. So as long as you're wearing clothes that are not tight fit, that are not exposing the shape of your body, then that would be fine. So you can wear abaya or you can wear loose pants and loose shirts.
Hassan, is it appropriate to, or I'll rephrase this in a little bit better of a way. What's the best way to respond to an elder, specifically an auntie in the community, who is spreading incorrect information and embarrassing you in front of others as a kid?
As a
kid or as a child.
So, yeah, that's awkward. I think the best thing to do is just approach them privately and just let them know that, you know, it's important to not make judgments about people's intentions. You know, sometimes aunties think that these stories are cute, even though they're not cute. So I think it's helpful to basically tell them that I don't doubt that you have good intentions and you're doing this. You know, you share these stories because you think that you're being very endearingly playful or whatever it may be. So make it clear that you're not making a judgment about what their motives are, but just let them know that I prefer if you don't share these stories because I find them embarrassing, even though you might not. So I think just having that open and honest conversation without sounding accusatory. Because if you sound accusatory and you start saying things like, you know, why are you destroying my reputation? You know, that's a comment that speaks to someone's intentions. So try to be neutral and assume the best of people. Don't assume that they're on a campaign to destroy your reputation. Just remind them that you would prefer that they don't share those stories.
Ascent. Who needs to take priority, my wife and kids or my parents? For example, if moving is better for our finances and kids and for the children's upbringing, but my parents prefer for me to stay.
So that is the struggle that every man faces. You know, balancing, you know, the pleasure of your parents with the comfort and the pleasure of your wife and your children. And it's not always black and white, and it's not always easy. I think ultimately, you see, you have a duty towards both. The problem is, when there's conflict, a lot of men, and even a lot of women, they're put in a position where they have to choose. that we treat these things as if they're mutually exclusive, that it's either me or your parents. I think that a husband and a wife, they have to be very, very careful about relationship with parents, meaning the husband's parents and the wife's parents. So when you make decisions that are displeasing to your parents, it's very, very important that, see, Islam doesn't say that every decision that you make in life, your parents have to approve of it. At the end of the day, you're an adult and you can make decisions. But there's a way to go about things. Sometimes we don't need to add insult to injury. We don't need to rub it in their faces. You know, if you can't please them, that at least try to make them less upset. And sometimes you have to just accept the fact that they're not going to be happy, but as a dutiful son, as a dutiful daughter, I'm going to go out of my way to make them less upset with me. Even if it means sending them flowers and gifts and staying in touch with them more often and just, you know, smothering them with praise and appreciation. You have to do that. These are your parents. So there are some parents who are difficult. I understand that. But you always have to remember that everybody has a test in life. Some people are tested with health issues. Some people are tested with financial issues. And some are tested with difficult parents, difficult in-laws, whatever it may be. So approach all of these challenges with that in mind. That try to do what is most pleasing to God. You know, and as I said, you will find yourself in some situations where you can't make your mom or your dad fully happy. But as I said, at least try to make them less upset to the best of your ability.
Ahsant, I learned by the way, I'm reading these questions, so it's not I learned. A person has learned a community woman is psychologically and verbally abusive to her husband. Are there Islamic examples of this being harmful, or should this be tolerated?
So can you repeat the question?
A person has learned a community woman is psychologically and verbally abusive to her husband. Let's just put it this way. Obviously, it should not be tolerated, so I think we can all answer that. But how is one to approach this in an Islamic manner, and also, I guess, for the greater good of the community?
So it's important to mention a few things here. Number one, before we intervene, it's important that we know for sure what is happening. We can't just rely on hearsay, because things are fabricated, things are misconstrued, things are distorted. So you don't want to intervene unless you know with 100% certainty that there is abuse taking place, number one. Number two, you should have an indication that your intervention is wanted, right? Maybe the family they're dealing with it in their own way. Maybe they're seeking help. So you shouldn't take it upon yourself to just, you know, swoop in and try to save the day. So if this is a close friend and you know for certain that this gentleman is being abused in the relationship, and it's important to note, brothers and sisters, that, you know, usually when we speak about spousal abuse, the narrative is the traditional narrative is that the husband is abusing the wife. The reality is that yes. Maybe in many cases that is the situation, but there are many husbands who are in abusive relationships. And because there's a stigma associated with men seeking help, especially in our cultures, for a man to be in a relationship where he is being abused by his wife, a lot of men feel that it would be emasculating for me to share this with others. So there is always going to be a reluctance to seek help. Now, if you are a friend and you know that this person is suffering, it could help to just offer help, because there are therapists, there are organizations that can provide assistance for people who are trapped in these types of relationships. So yes, I mean, it shouldn't be tolerated in the sense that something has to be done to eliminate and eliminate that abuse. That doesn't mean, see, the problem is a lot of times when these things happen, we automatically want to jump to divorce and let's just completely break up the family. a lot of problems can be resolved through counseling. So our first reaction shouldn't be divorce and let them go their separate ways. We come from a tradition that believes in redemption. People can redeem themselves. People who are abusive, yes, unfortunately, it's very difficult for them to desist, but things can be done to salvage those types of relationships. So if you are in a position and you know the facts and you're not making assumptions and there is you have seen signs that there's a desire for intervention from you, then you can provide the resources that are needed to help this person. Now, oftentimes, we're not qualified to give specific advice. And this is very damaging. You know, sometimes you might have a friend who's in an abusive relationship and you're not a counselor and you're not a therapist and you don't have experience. The only thing that you have is that this person is your friend. And what often happens is you're biased and you're probably not going to give them very good advice. And you could potentially even exacerbate the problem. So everyone has to know their limits. You can be a friend, but you don't need to be a therapist. You don't need to be giving unsolicited advice that could impact a person's family life. So if you're not a subject expert, it's important that you direct them to people who specialize in dealing with these cases.
Hassan, the next, I'm actually going to kind of combine these two questions because they intertwine with each other quite well. When do we have a social responsibility to encourage others to increase their level of resistance today with regards to Palestine? And then to offshoot from that, how do we deal with other Shias who want to keep Palestine out of the Majalis of Imam Hussein? So increase the level of resistance, and also how do we deal with people who are trying to diminish
that? So it's not our responsibility to dictate to people the level of Nahi an al-Munkar that they need to observe. Why? We know that when there is corruption or injustice in society, Muslims have a duty to forbid evil. Now, forbidding evil, it exists on a spectrum, depending on your circumstances. There is a level of Nahi an al-Munkar that is individually obligatory upon each person. And that is at the level of the heart. Al-Inkar al-Qalbi. At the level of the heart, every Muslim should renounce injustice. What is happening in Gaza, at a bare minimum, you cannot be okay with what is happening. You have to be angry, you have to be upset, you have to denounce what you see. That degree of Nahi an al-Munkar, that is an obligation upon everybody. Because it's on the level of the heart, we don't know who's doing it and who's failing. Because it's at the level of the heart. The hadith of the Prophet says, if you see evil in society, change it with your hand, if you are able to. If you are in a position of power and you can make change, if you have that ability, then do so. If you're unable to do so, then the second level, which is at least speak out against it. Resist with your tongue. If you are unable to resist with your tongue, then at least resist with your heart, and that is the lowest degree of faith. The problem, my dear brothers and sisters, is that because we don't know people's circumstances, I cannot determine what your duty is. In the same way, if I walk in, if it's the time of salah, and I see someone doing tayammum, it's not my job to be like, how come you're not doing tayammum? How come you're not doing wudu with water? If they say, well, I don't feel good, is it my duty to be like, I don't believe you, let's go to the doctor. Prove it to me. That's not our job. My job is to fulfill my duty. Because the lowest level of Nahi an al-Munkar is al-Inkar al-Qalbi, it could be that they're fulfilling their duty. So we can't dictate to others what they need to do. Everybody just needs to mind their own business and focus on what your obligation is. There might be people who can resist militarily. They have to make that determination. There are those who are going to resist with their tongues. If you're able to do that, great. If you're able to do that and you don't, then Allah is going to hold you accountable. But it's not my job to conduct a full-fledged investigation to see what you're able to and what you're not able to do. So what has happened over the past 10, 11 months is that a lot of people are playing the Nahi an al-Munkar police. And they are demanding that that Nahi an al-Munkar has to look the same for everybody. I'll give you a simple example. Imagine you have a Muslim who works in an organization. And let's say that this person is a Muslim chaplain. And that position in the university is very important. This person has helped many Muslims over the years. And let's say if this person speaks out and says something against the Zionists, they'll lose their job. This person at that moment has to do a cost and benefit analysis. Is it worth it to post something on social media and lose this critical position in a university or an institution? They might make the determination that it's better for me not to say something. Not because I support what's happening, but it's more strategic for me to hold on to this position. Because if people are reckless in their nahi an al-munkar, what's going to end up happening is that people might lose strategic positions, and then we have a community of people who are unemployed, who don't have any power anymore. So sometimes people have to make strategic moves. Not because they're sellouts, or they work for the CIA, or they work for, you know, MI6. They're making their determination on what is the best form of resistance. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that everybody needs to just mind their own business. You know, because if you look at the time of the Prophet, if you look at what happened after the Prophet, Abu Dhar was very vocal. Salman, for example, was less vocal against Muawiyah. Does that mean that Abu Dhar is great and Salman, we just throw him in the bin? So we all have the same goal, but we don't necessarily have the same roles. Everybody has a different role to play, depending on their context. So that's why there's a need for nuance. Things are not black and white. Things are not black. Even if you look at the imams of Ahlul Bayt, sometimes the imams themselves, they would not issue public condemnations against the rulers, because they know if they say something, they'll get killed. So it's better for Islam for them to preserve their lives. See, Imam Hussein sacrificed when he knew that his blood would create a catalyst. Something good would come out of his martyrdom. But we shouldn't put ourselves in situations where we're subjecting ourselves to harm and there is no well thought out plan as to what the impact is going to be. So we have to be much more strategic and thoughtful.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so if it's a close friend, and let's say that you know their situation and their circumstances, and you know that they could say something, and it's not going to be detrimental or it's not going to result in some sort of undue harm, then yeah, that would be an example of Amr bil Ma'ruf. But the point is, you can't just go to a random stranger and condemn them for not being vocal. We don't know what their circumstances are. You know, maybe their lives are in danger. Maybe they're trying to shield themselves from a substantial harm. If it's someone that you know and you know them well enough and you have that type of relationship, and you say to them that, listen, you know, you live in a society that allows freedom of speech and there's nothing to fear, you should be more vocal. That's totally fine. But oftentimes what happens is people go online and they're just slaughtering the entire Shia community. And they're just doing takfir and la'na upon anyone that doesn't do this and that. That's problematic. That fragments our community. So we have to have husn al-dhan. We have to have a good opinion of people, assuming that you're fulfilling your responsibility. You know, because nahi an al-munkar at minimum can exist at the level of the heart, we can't assume that people are not fulfilling their duty.
Hassan, what should a daughter or son do about a father that is emotionally and physically abusive to their mother? Do they have the responsibility to protect that mother?
Yeah, this is unfortunate because it happens too often. You know, as a Muslim, we have a responsibility to help anyone, if we are able to help anyone who's being physically abused and physically assaulted. And unfortunately, when it's the father, a lot of children are in a situation where they're afraid to do anything and they're afraid to speak out because they're worried that if, you know, if I pick up the phone and call the cops and I seek help, you know, my dad is going to go to prison and then my family is going to be fractured. I think that the best thing to do is, if your father is abusing your mother, number one, if it's happening in front of you, then you should try to shield her and protect her from that immediate attack. I think that the next step that you have to take is, I personally don't believe it's necessary to immediately escalate to law enforcement, because what can happen, especially if you're dealing with little children, the family might be permanently broken up. And they might, you know, Child Protective Services might deem that this is not a safe environment for the kids. And then, you know, you create a bigger problem. So I think that there are organizations that provide help and resources to people who are dealing with domestic violence. Reach out to those, you know, these nonprofit organizations before you escalate it to law enforcement and see what can be done. And if need be, then the mother can be taken out of the house. If there is a genuine fear for her safety, she shouldn't be under the same roof as a man who's physically assaulting her. So that might be a first step. And you know, if the father is an abusive person, you might have to give the father an ultimatum that, listen, if you don't get help, we're going to have to call law enforcement. So you have to decide how this is going to go. But we're not going to stand by and allow you to physically assault our mother. So that might be the best course of action. And again, it's complicated. You know, there might be situations where you might have to immediately reach out to law enforcement because it's a matter of life and death, or it could be a situation where the woman can become severely injured. So it's really a case by case, and you have to just make the determination of how, whether to escalate it to law enforcement or reach out to organizations that deal with domestic violence.
Excellent. What to do when creating specific boundaries with elders within the community comes off as disrespectful to them?
You guys ask tough questions, man. So, you know, the reality is, brothers and sisters, sometimes you have to set boundaries for your mental sanity. You have to. And if you do it in a way that's polite, you are not responsible for how offended people get. Because at the end of the day, you have to protect your sanity. And if people are being intrusive and their comments are truly hurting you and they're damaging you, then you politely are allowed to kind of create that distance. Now, if the reaction to that is you're a terrible person and you're this and that, that's between them and Allah. But there is nothing. Islam doesn't say that you need to be a doormat for people and you need to allow people to walk all over you and invade your privacy. You know, every human being has dignity. And if the only way to preserve your dignity is to set those boundaries, then you have the right to do so. But but always we have to remember that we should speak to people with ihsan, with kindness. We should pay attention to the words that we choose, our tone. Now, if you do that, if you observe perfect akhlaq and someone is still offended, then make dua for them. Send them chocolates. I don't know. Some people are just always going to be offended. And it's not our job to make sure that someone's feelings are not hurt. You know, you do your best, and some people are going to be offended no matter what you do. So that's life.
Sant, what do you think should be done to create a culture of religious literacy in centers in the West?
So this is very important, and I dedicate my life work to this. If we want to create a culture of religious literacy, we have to stop associating a majlis with real Islamic education. So I'll repeat that. We have to stop associating attending a majlis with real Islamic education. You are not going to be Islamically literate just from attending a majlis. Because you know what? The moment you get to your car, you will only remember about 20% of what you heard. And by the time you get home, it's probably going to be 5%. And after you get into an argument with your siblings before you go to bed, it's probably going to be 1%. The reality is that these majalis, the primary function of a majlis is to motivate and to inspire you to put in the time and pursue Islamic education. The majlis is a reminder. The majlis is not, yes, you can learn a lot from a majlis, but oftentimes, what do you get out of a majlis? If you get a decent speaker, you'll have a coherent subject. You know, the speaker will stick to the topic. But in many cases, what happens? A speaker comes, the beginning of the lecture was about hijab, and the end of the lecture was about how, you know, husband and wives, you know, should, you know, make peace with each other. And in the middle of the lecture, there's a discussion about fada'il. So oftentimes, you're getting just bits and pieces of information, and you don't really understand how all of this is tied together. So Islamic education needs to be done in a structured and in a methodical way. I've met many people, they've been attending, you know, if you think about it, the Shia community is the most lectured community of all religions of the world. Think about it. I don't think there's any other religious community that attends more lectures than we do. And the reality is, we don't really have much to show for in terms of our knowledge and our akhlaq in many cases. I'm sorry to say that. But that's the reality. That means that this is not the most effective way of disseminating Islamic knowledge. If you want to be Islamically literate, there is no shortcut. Right? Everybody looks for shortcuts these days. You know, you want to write a paper? ChatGPT. Right? You want to lose, you know, 10 pounds? You know, what is the best diet pill that I can take? Everybody wants shortcuts. When it comes to Islamic education, there is no elevator. You have to take the stairs. It requires work. You got to devote time. And there is no excuse. You know, when I was growing up, I remember attending the maqtal of Imam al-Hussein, and I think I was like 9 or 10 years old. And at that time, I didn't really understand Arabic because it was very high-level Arabic. There was a Lebanese brother who used to listen to the maqtal, and we would have headsets, and he would translate the maqtal in real time into English. And that is the only English program we had all year. Just an hour and a half of listening to the translation of the maqtal. Now, we have unlimited educational resources. You go online and you type Hawza online, you can enroll in a 4 to 5 year program and you can develop a very solid foundation. I mean, I started an organization in 2018 called Tasneem Institute, and that's what we do. You know, between the month of Ramadan and the month of Muharram and Safar, we try to fill in the gaps so people have quality educational content throughout the year. So the problem is that we think that, okay, if we hold a majlis, we're serving the community. Majalis are important, but you are not going to develop Islamic literacy just by attending a majlis. Especially because most people are not even, you know, either they're not paying attention and they're not taking notes. So it's very passive learning. You're not being tested. You're not really reviewing any of this material. You might be inspired by a story, but you know, give it a few days, you'll barely even remember what was the ayah that he spoke about, what was the story. It needs review, it needs time. So in the same way we devote so much time to our secular studies, because we want to live a comfortable life, and by the way, life is not going to last more than 80, 90, 100 years. When our Islamic education is going to dictate the quality of our eternal life. So at the very least, devote at least an hour, 2 hours to it a week. And many of us, we commute to work. Instead of listening to, again, my pop culture references are highly outdated, so I'm not going to try. Instead of listening to, you know, whoever the most famous singer is today, listen to something that's going to actually enrich your soul, that's going to intellectually stimulate you. Because it's not cute being dumb. It's really not. You know, the most unattractive thing is for someone to be dumb. And you can, it's not a hadith, by the way, but you can quote me on that.
So with that being said, Sheikh, I'll afterwards ask you about, and this is to answer a question that's already been embedded in this, your top three books, I guess, you know, for educational purposes, then I can post that on Behunity for everybody.
My top three books?
Yes, your top three books.
Should I give the Sheikh answer?
You can.
Quran Nahj al-Balagha Sahih al-Sajjad.
There you go, yeah.
So I'll give you some unconventional books that I've read that I think are very, very important. So there's a book that Sheikh Bahmanpour wrote several years ago. And I think the book is called Eternal Life. I think that's the title. I'm not 100% sure, but Eternal Life is definitely in the title. So just type in Eternal Life, Sheikh Bahmanpour. That book is probably the best book I've read in English or even in Arabic on the journey of the soul after death. It's one of those books. And by the way, I don't believe in making you read books because I'm trying to scare you into becoming a pious person. The book is just written so well that it makes you almost look forward to what's going to happen after death. Not like in a suicidal way or anything like that, but it makes you appreciate how much life there is on the other side. And it gives you hope that you get to play a role in building that life on the other side. So it's a book that inspires a lot of hope. You know, because oftentimes you feel like we don't have control over our lives, but that book, to me, when I read it, it had that wow factor that, wow, there is so much that is in our hands. There's so much that we can do to improve our worldly lives and the life that awaits us after death. So that's one. Another book that I'm actually reading it at the moment, and it's a book that is called Islamic Beliefs, Reclaiming the Narrative. This book is a translation of the month of Ramadan lectures that Sayyid Khamenei gave in 1974. And I was actually not very familiar with his style and his speaking and his content. If you read that book, you will be blown away. And he was 35 years old when he was delivering these sermons. And he was, at the end of the month, he was actually arrested by the Shah's authorities. So those were some of the most revolutionary lectures. And, you know, and this is not an endorsement of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm not trying to get into that. I want you to just read it and just focus on the theological, the ethical, and the metaphysical content in that book, because it will change your perspective on a lot of things that you thought you understood, like Tawbah. I'll give you just one example that really resonated with me. In the book, he talks about the concept of infaq. Does anyone know what the word infaq means? You know, nafaqah, to spend in the way of God. So in one of his lectures, he talks about how many people, they misunderstand the meaning of infaq. You know, because when Allah speaks about the believers, He says, الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ, those who do infaq fi sabili Allah. When we think about spending in the way of God, we think that it's just about intention. If I give this in the way of God, that's infaq. But he says that infaq comes from the word nafaq, which means whole. And giving in the way of God, infaq from an Islamic perspective, it means giving in a way that fills a gap in society. So it's not just about giving. It's about identifying a problem in society and spending and actually solving and filling gaps in society. So, you know, sometimes, you know, there might be some community that says, you know, we want to build something in our center, a structure in our center, a dome, a minaret, and we're going to spend $100,000, $200,000. And we think that, okay, this is infaq fi sabilillah. You're donating, but does that act qualify as true infaq? Because infaq means that you're actually filling a gap in society. Yes, you're giving money, but are you actually solving real life problems? So I mean, that's just a tidbit of some of the things that he talks about. So that's a second book that I would recommend. A third book, okay. I'm trying to go through the library of the books that I've read. Another book that I would recommend Yeah, I might have to come back to that. Okay, yeah. I need a few more minutes.
I can always post that on on BeCunity. Okay. What is the best way to let youth know that attending Majlis or doing Matam does not replace Salat?
Because the person who you're commemorating prayed on the 10th of Muharram in the middle of the battle. Next question.
I had one right here. Oh, yeah. How do you motivate your husband to take initiative in daily life to become a proper leader within the family, leading the children, tarbiyah, finances, so on and so forth?
Don't cook for him until he does.
There you go.
You sisters have a lot of power, man, I'm telling you. You can leverage some of that power.
These are quick ones.
The brother's like, that was the answer? Yeah, that was the answer.
How does one go about praying and doing wudu with a colostomy bag? What are the rules of najasa that apply?
When they have a what
colostomy bag? Is,
okay.
Is, yeah.
So, how do they do wudu? So,
or what are the rules of najasa within that?
So as long as it doesn't go beyond that area of that incision in that bag, then they don't have to kind of purify that beyond that area. But if the urine is coming out of that area, then it would invalidate their wudu and they would have to do wudu.
Excellent. One loud salawat and before the final question. What should our relationship with money be as a second-generation immigrant who now has well-paying jobs? Is it appropriate to have fancy cars and big houses?
So there is nothing wrong with enjoying your halal earned wealth. The issue is that we have to have balance. So it's important that we earn our money in a way that's lawful. And it's also important that we spend our money in a way that's lawful. And you have to live within your means, meaning that you shouldn't be going into debt, you know, to keep up with the Joneses, and you know, you got to buy the latest car, the newest Tesla. You have to live within your means. Now, in Islam, if you are paying your religious dues, you're paying your zakat and your khums, and you want to make your family comfortable. There's nothing wrong. It's actually mustahab to make your family financially comfortable. It's mustahab to do that. But at the same time, you know, just as you enjoy these divine gifts, in addition to paying your religious dues, it's also important to set aside some money to help the less fortunate, even beyond, going above and beyond the bare minimum. It's also important that, you see, a lot of families that are affluent, without realizing it, they end up spoiling their kids. And their kids, they grow up not understanding the value of money because everything came easy. And therefore, I think that even if you are a high earner, you have to remember that if you want the best for your kids, showing love to your kids doesn't only always mean that you give them a credit card. They have to learn how to struggle in life, because if they don't learn how to fend for themselves, how to struggle, they're going to be incompetent people. They're going to go through life on a crutch. So in the same way that you built wealth because you know you were in the trenches and you went through the difficulties, if these kids are born with a golden spoon in their mouths, then they're not going to have that tenacity. So you can buy nice things for your family, that's fine. But it's important that, especially when it comes to boys, because boys, they're going to have a responsibility to be protectors and providers. I think that young boys, especially in the summertime, they should not be hanging out at home and playing video games all day. They should get jobs. Right? 13, 14, now I'm not saying that we got to send them to the sweatshops or anything like that. But I'm saying that have them do work around the house. You know, it is not healthy to assume that domestic chores are only the domain of sisters or the girls in the family. I think that if you want to be an adult in the real world, every man should know how to cook and clean and do all of these things, because you need to be You need to be independent on the days that your wife is mad at you. So I think that these are life skills that you need to have. And I think it's a beautiful thing to be able to step up to the plate on the days that your wife is not able to do those things. I think that's what being a man is, that you're able to kind of lift the burden. You are a provider, you are a protector, you are the rock of the family. If you can't even make, you know, chai or you know fry an egg, then you need to get your act together. You need to increase your skill set, because if you want to be the head of the tribe, you have to have that servant leader mentality. Right? So you're the leader, but you're also at the service of your family. So when you make a lot of money, the tendency is that you want to just spoil your kids and give them the newest gadgets. But you know, if you want to buy your kids something, at least let them work for it. Cut the grass, you know, wash my car, do this and that. Let them work. You know, tell them that during the summertime they have to read X amount of books. They have to take 2 Hausa classes before they can, you know, upgrade their phone or whatever. By the way, I don't think they should even have a phone. I think we're spoiling our kids too much. We're spoiling them too much. And a lot of these young boys, especially the boys, they need to toughen up, because the world is going to smack them when they get 18, 19, 20 years old. The world is not cotton candy and marshmallows. You need a lot of strength and resilience, and you need to be smart, you need to be wise, and you're not going to develop those skills, you know, sitting on the couch and playing video games. You have to get out into the real world. And I think that fathers have a duty to mentor their boys. And I think that, you know, there are some camps, you know, maybe they need to join Boy Scouts. They need to learn how to fend them for themselves. They need to play some contact sports. You know, I personally think that the boys need to get roughed up a little bit, because you don't want to end up being that guy who gets married and, you know, you're walking down the street and some hillbilly guy comes and insults your wife and, you know, you're the one who has to hide behind her because you're scared. You have to be able to defend yourself, because we live in a world where it's becoming increasingly dangerous. It is very plausible that there might be a situation where someone physically tries to attack your wife. So you have to have the physical strength to defend yourself and to defend your family. So summertime, when you have time off, I think the boys should be involved in some sort of martial arts. You should be working, and you should try to acquire as many skills as you can to earn money for your family when you get married and have kids. That should be the mindset. We have to create a warrior mindset. Not like, I don't care if you're the best player at Fortnite. That's the dorkiest thing in the world. You know, learn a real skill. So, anyway.
Hassan, Sheikh, honestly, you have probably dropped some of the, a lot of valuable takeaways for all of us in this community, myself included. So thank you from the bottom of all of our hearts, inshallah. We pray that you will come back soon. For a lot of the people who have asked questions, I know there's a lot of questions that I really wanted to get through. Unfortunately, time has been quite a bit of a constraint. Questions that are very related to fiqhi things, I kind of shied away from, just because those questions, should be answerable if you, either go on Sistani's website or if you follow up with your respected marja. So for the ones that were wondering how come some of those questions weren't asked, it's for that reason. But inshallah, hopefully Sheikh will be back next year, inshallah, or the year after, and we'll have a little bit more time with him. So please pray for him and pray for his health and pray for his return back to this masjid. So. Did he tell you this?
I guess I'm coming back in December. Yeah.
He's coming back in December. So, all right. A loud salawat for Sheikh and for his family.
So this is the awkward moment where we just get up and just the session ends. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.